Thousands of Puerto Ricans are relocating here to Florida after a devastating storm. Just ahead, how that's reshaping the island and the Sunshine State, too. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend out there. We are always live on the radio at 9. You can also get our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through the WJCT app. Just ahead, teenaged author Jose Lopez on fleeing his home, Puerto Rico, in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. He's writing a book about the experience now that he has electricity. You can get on the line now and connect with Jose at 549-2937. Then later, working to protect Florida's trees, we'll tell you why local and state activists are battling to fight legislation they say would decimate our tree canopy. Plus, Culpepper on last night's wild game against Seattle. Did you watch that? Wow. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Puerto Rico is still in dire straits, months after Hurricane Maria ravaged the U.S. territory. It's shaping up to be a bleak Christmas there, with about half the island still without electricity and a large percentage without even clean water. Now, keep in mind, these are U.S. citizens down there, and the storm blitzed the island on September 20th. That is nearly 3 months ago. Many have been forced to leave their home, including one young and successful author who hails from Puerto Rico. Jose Lopez has written a series of best-selling books on how to market your business on Instagram. And he's still a teenager. How about that? But when the island of Puerto Rico faced the worst catastrophe in nearly a century, Hurricane Maria, Jose experienced the brunt of that storm firsthand, and what he went through changed his life forever. As an author, Jose Lopez felt he had to help in the best way he knew how, by documenting the tragedy he saw all around him, along with the heroism he was witnessing every day. But there was no electricity, so he had to handwrite notes on what he saw so that one day these stories could be told. Later, Lopez and his family were forced to leave Puerto Rico and relocate here to Florida. At last now, he's got access to electricity and a computer, and so the young author is writing a memoir of what he went through in Hurricane Maria and the aftermath. We're going to hear his story now as Jose Lopez joins us by phone. He's teenage author on Twitter, by the way. Jose Lopez, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you on the show, and here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the dire situation still ongoing now in Puerto Rico nearly 3 months after Hurricane Maria? What are your questions for teenage author Jose Lopez? The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And you can weigh in on Facebook as well. So let me begin, Jose, by saying congratulations on all your success as a teenaged author. You'd already written some very well-received internet marketing books before any of this happened. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's actually right. I've had written a few marketing books before because as a teenager, you know that our platform is social media and specifically Instagram. So I just wrote what I knew about and what I loved about, and that was Instagram.
Sure. A lot of teenagers love Instagram, and your series shows people how to market their business on Instagram, which is certainly a burgeoning platform that people can monetize on social media. So you're media savvy. You're young. By the way, how old are you, Jose?
I actually just turned 17 a few weeks ago.
Wow. Not even 18 yet. So there you are.
Nope.
There you are on the island, and Hurricane Maria comes through. Can you describe what you and your family went through during the storm and after the storm?
Yeah, I mean, I was 16 at the time. That all happened before I turned 17. And I lived in Florida, I've lived in Texas, and I've lived in Puerto Rico, and I've just shifted. But never in my life had I encountered an event that the aftermath of the event would have so much impact on an entire nation. I had seen tornadoes in Texas, I had seen floods, I had seen fires, but never in my life I had seen how an entire nation would be in distress and chaos because a single event caused everything to just go out of order.
Sure. No electricity, no clean water. What happened to your home?
Okay, so I live in a city called Isabela. Our home, per se, didn't have much damages. A lot of the trees and a lot of the greenery around our home did. But we lived near a dam, which was the Guajataca Dam. And what happened to our, you know, home and our neighborhood was that we lived near that dam. And I remember, like, it was yesterday. So the hurricanes happened Wednesday. And on Friday, there was rumors that the dam had received some structural damage and that there was, you know, the possibility that it would actually break. If it did, we had no idea which neighborhoods or which places would be affected and flooded. So where I lived, it was on constant, let's say, fear that in the middle of the night or in the middle of the day, we would just see water start flooding in. And we would have to, you know, get on our roofs and try to stay afloat because the dam, if it broke, it had so much water in it. We didn't know who would be affected and if it would reach us.
Mm. And so what finally happened?
So as far as the government didn't really explain completely what went on with the dam. I remember on Saturday, I went to a relative's house, which they had a generator. And they hooked up the television. And the only thing that was going on that, you know, the media was saying was that they were showing aerial footage from a helicopter that the U.S. Corps of Engineers had sent. And they were just showing aerial footage of the dam and how it was. We didn't know if it was, you know, extreme dangerous or if it was just a normal, you know, bit happened but it won't break. So... at, you know, until I left in October 30, it didn't break, but because, the engineers of the U.S. along with the engineers of Puerto Rico were working, you know, nonstop to actually prevent any type of damage and flooding through the houses. So, you know, it's good that nothing happened per se, but the threat was still there and the tension, because since we didn't have communications, we didn't have TV, we didn't have Facebook, anything. We were like in the old times. We were neighbor to neighbor. We would go and we would talk.
Just to get information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's actually one of the problems that happened because, you know, that information spreads really quickly, but so does misinformation. So
lots of rumor. I guess a lot of rumors were spreading like wildfire with no social media to confirm anything, right?
Exactly. So the problem that we encountered was that the way that we got the first word that there was something going on was that because the U.S. government and then the army and the police of Puerto Rico, they were actually going through, you know, certain sectors of our town saying, hey, you guys have to evacuate now. And one of the neighbors that we had relatives that were in that, you know, emergency sector. And that neighbor came to us saying, hey, I have a relative who was in X sector, and she just came to me because the army just told her, hey, there's an emergency, you have to leave. And he wasn't able to, you know, give us much information because the army itself didn't want to, you know, spread certain types of information just in case it wasn't completely confirmed. And the problem that we were having was that should we actually go to everyone we knew in the other neighborhoods and, you know, warn them, or should we wait until we could get some confirmation, you know, some official confirmation, and then, you know, try to address the situation and get people informed.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with teenage author Jose Lopez about his experience on Puerto Rico as Hurricane Maria roared through and devastated the island and U.S. territory. Jose and his family are like so many others. They've come here to Florida in the aftermath of the devastation on the island, half the island still without power, a big chunk of the island still without clean water months after the storm. We'll go to your calls in just a moment, along with your tweets and emails. The number to join the show, what are your thoughts about Puerto Rico's dire situation? The number to join us is 549-2937. So, Jose, after all of this, Your family then made the decision to come here to Florida, correct? You just decided it was time to go.
I mean, what actually happened was that my parents work in an IT company, and the IT company actually has headquarters in the U.S. So since the infrastructure, the electricity, and the internet was completely destroyed, the headquarters said, hey, if you guys could actually, you know, relocate and to the U.S. and work from home, that way we could still keep operating. So, you know, that door was opened. And as soon as that door was opened from HQ in the U.S., my parents said, hey, we need to leave, period. You know, we need to leave. So we had two decisions. We had either we go back to Texas or we go back to Florida. And, you know, the door's open. And luckily, we were able to move to Florida, which is, you know, closer to Puerto Rico. And from over here, we could actually help the, you know, our relatives still in Puerto Rico. We have relatives in the center of the island that have nothing yet. Their roads were closed. They have no gas. They have nothing. So from over here, we're trying to help as much as we can, sending supplies and sending, you know, batteries, which they don't have either, to, you know, and stuff like that. So that's how we basically ended over here.
And where are you located now in Florida? Where's your family staying?
We're actually staying in Spring Hill. So we stayed in a hotel for a few weeks because we were trying to find a place to stay. But we found a house in Spring Hill, and we're just staying over here for the moment.
Okay, and that's north of Tampa, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That's correct.
So you're writing a book. You're an author. You've published successfully at the age of 16 already, 17. You're writing a book about, a memoir about your experience with Hurricane Maria. I'm sure that's got to be deeply emotional for you, and you finally now have electricity to write it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I actually started writing the book since it happened in September 20. But what I thought was going to happen initially, I said, hey, I'm going to document this, but I'm sure it's not going to be full length of a book, because I just thought it was going to be, you know, the day it happened and maybe the day after and, you know, maybe 1 or 2 days. It turned out that for the next 3 days, so many things went on that I have approximately 1/3 of a book already in 3 days, that, you know, in a 3-day time span. And after that, for the next 40 days, which was the time that I spent in Puerto Rico, so many things went on. You know, maybe one day something didn't go on, but then the next day something did go on. And it was just a complete journey. So I just documented all that in notebooks. I have different notebooks that I write on. Whenever my phone had charge, because we would charge it inside our cars, then I would, you know, get notes on my phone. But after that, I just said, someday I want to publish what I went through in the island in order to someday, you know, be able to touch lives of those who weren't there but could experience what I went through. It like if they were there. So that's pretty much my journey with this memoir. It's trying to, you know, touch the lives of those who weren't there, and also trying to give hope back to those who are still in Puerto Rico that haven't been able to, you know, leave or get some help.
What's the book going to be called?
It's actually going to be called Determined, not because of my personal journey, but the title was actually chosen because I wanted to highlight how the people of Puerto Rico are determined to get back up, no matter what they went through or what they lost. So it's called Determined because of that.
Let's go to your feedback now for teenaged author Jose Lopez. He's now a Florida resident. He and his family were forced to relocate here, like so many other Puerto Ricans, in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. We'll go to your calls in just a moment. The number to join the show, 549-2937. First, though, I'm going to let you know, Jose, what we're getting in the way of social media feedback to your experience. Lots of comments. Let's go to our First Coast Connect Facebook page first. Rhea writes, when was the last time, or even decade, that Puerto Rico had such widespread rural lack of electricity? And what are the biggest changes, both good and bad, that came with modern appliances? So this is unprecedented, isn't it, that Puerto Rico would be without power for this long. It'll be 3 months next week.
Yeah. So as far as the question, from what, you know, I'm 17, so I haven't lived decades long. But I have talked. I remember that Hurricane Irma passed Puerto Rico just a few weeks before Maria. And I actually went to visit my grandmother, which lived in the center of the island. And I asked her, I was like, hey, Grandma, how was it in the old times whenever a huge hurricane would happen? And she actually had lived a few of the, you know, major hurricanes that happened before Maria. And she told me it was honestly not... It was, you know, the damage per se was just the houses and the farms and stuff like that. But since there wasn't much electricity and much development, you know, industrial development, the damages weren't so heavy and evident. But from what I lived over here, since this was basically the first time ever that Puerto Rico went through such a huge event, with so much development in terms of the internet and social media and everything. So it was kind of a new experience for the entire nation. And as far as electricity goes, I honestly believe that it could have been maybe since the last Category 4 or 5 hurricane, which hit the island, which was almost a century ago.
Yeah. All right, here's a tweet for you from a listener. Does Jose feel that FEMA's response to Maria in Puerto Rico has been adequate, or is it lacking compared to other cities like Houston? And what are his thoughts about President Trump's visit to Puerto Rico and his comments regarding the disaster? Because, of course, many Puerto Ricans feel, and I don't know if you agree, Jose, but many Puerto Ricans feel that the federal response to Hurricane Maria has been lacking, to say the least. What are your thoughts about that?
All right, yeah, that's a really good question. It's a tricky question. As far as the first question was about FEMA, so for the time that I was there, 40 days, I will be honest, completely honest. I didn't see a single blue tarp, which is the signature, whenever FEMA goes to a house and they actually repair a roof, they will throw a blue tarp over it, marking it as, we are going to get back at you and we're going to help you rebuild it. So that's the signature, you know, emergency signature that we could, you know, distinguish. And for the time that I was in Puerto Rico, I didn't see a single blue tarp go up. Then again, I lived in the rural area. I lived very far west from the metropolitan area. So it's kind of hard for me to, you know, say nothing was going on, because I'm sure things were going on, but I'm sure they were going on, you know, in the metropolitan areas like San Juan, which is, you know, the capital, and Bayamón, which is another, you know, big industrial place. So as far as that, I couldn't really comment, because I only stayed within a 50-mile radius of where I lived. As far as Donald Trump's visit, that actually, you know, sparked something more, because I remember seeing it on the news and I couldn't believe what was going on, because I said, you know, his etiquette whenever he took a visit and whenever he was addressing the nation and us, it wasn't formal. But then again, you know, we have a president who is known to be like that, and I have nothing against them. I actually, you know, admire some of his decisions, but not all of them. And the way he addressed the Puerto Rican nation, just wasn't, you know, as good as it should have been. And the people of Puerto Rico noticed, and the people of Puerto Rico said, instead of tossing paper towels at us, why don't you try to give us more hope, or try to explain how the U.S. will actually do X or Y thing? So his visit wasn't as, you know, constructive, but I feel like at least his partnership and his relation with the government of Puerto Rico had helped. Yes, they actually had helped Puerto Rico, and they're still helping us get back up.
Yeah, and do you hope to go back, or do you see yourself now as a Florida resident?
Okay, I actually wish and I hope that I go back very soon. Since I was in Texas and since I was in Florida, you know, I've lived in different states. And I've always wanted to be able to live in Puerto Rico, like, permanently. And it turns out that I moved to Puerto Rico on March 2017. And with the hope that I would finish high school and start going to college in Puerto Rico, you know, settle down and stay there. Turns out that Jerk and Maria hit and my plans were completely shifted. And that, you know, hope of staying in Puerto Rico and settling down was just changed. And that's when I learned and that's when I understood that in life, nothing is guaranteed. And that even though you may hope to stay in some place or, you know, settle in some place, things sometimes go a different direction and you just have to accept it and go along with it.
Yeah. Well, you're an incredibly impressive young man, and I know big things are in your future. We look forward to reading your memoir when it's published, Jose. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
He's Jose Lopez, only 17 years old and already a published author. His new memoir about Hurricane Maria, called Determined, will be published soon. And much more still ahead on the show later. How about that game last night? Cole Pepper, as the Jaguars now are just one win away from clinching a playoff spot. But up next, the battle to defend Florida's trees. Yes, it's trees. We'll tell you about that right after this.
Hendrix Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson with a quick question. Are you a good listener? I'd guess you say you are, but why is it that at a time when we can consume more news and listen to more radio than ever, many of us have just stopped listening to each other? Every day on 1A, we'll champion your right to speak freely, and we know you're ready to talk. So join me, Joshua Johnson, next time on 1A from WAMU and NPR. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, February 10th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 and 2017 events will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues, learn new ways to engage students, and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets today at wjct.org/teach.
Consider the time you spend on Saturday mornings listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or weekday mornings tuning into First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross. Your past support has made all this possible. As 2017 comes to a close, your year-end donation will ensure the programs you rely on continue to thrive throughout the year to come. You can give now at WJCT.org.
Welcome back. Well, a group of local and state activists is gearing up this week to fight proposed legislation in Tallahassee. They say takes aim at our lush tree canopy. Yes, the group Defend Florida Trees will be holding a press conference about this later in Jacksonville this morning. Right now, we welcome John November. He's the Defend Florida Trees campaign manager and executive director and general counsel for the Public Trust Environmental Legal Institute. John, good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Good to have you on the show. Also with us in studio, Anna Dooley, executive director of Greenscape of Jacksonville.
Hi, Melissa.
Good to see you, Anna. John, let's begin with you. There were a couple of bills that are expected to move this legislative session, which kicks off next month in Tallahassee. Your group says that they would prevent local governments like our own Duval County, Jacksonville City Council from protecting our tree canopy? How would these bills work to opposing them?
Yeah, there's some legislation in Tallahassee, House Bill 521 and Senate Bill 574, and they essentially are going to prohibit local governments from regulating trees on private property. And this would have a devastating effect on our local communities, and it would prevent local established laws from protecting trees in the way that they've been created over many years. We had a charter amendment in 2000, and it was recently strengthened again, and we've had a lot of support. And the idea of having all of our old growth forests and our most special trees, creating a window where these trees could be clear cut, is just an absolute travesty and something that we have to fight as a community against.
You're already getting bipartisan support on the Jacksonville City Council. Anna Dooley, Executive Director of Greenscape of Jacksonville, Councilman John Cressenbeny, along with a bipartisan cohort of other council members, are sponsoring a resolution that Cressenbeny put forth opposing this proposed new state law. And governments across Florida are also rising up in a bipartisan manner to voice their opposition. It seems everyone can agree on this thing in terms of people want their tree canopy wherever they live in Florida.
Exactly. And as John referred to, the year 2000, when the strengthened tree ordinance was done, Duval County spoke loudly with a margin of 76% of the vote, as well as every single precinct spoke in behalf of strengthening it, trying to protect our trees. Our trees are one of our most valuable resources right after the St. John's River, and we rely on them for so many things.
Such as
what may come in handy, a stormwater abatement. Good Lord, after these hurricanes, a lot of that could not be avoided. But yes, that very critical for that. Providing shade, providing habitat, just higher real estate values, lower utility costs. Trees are critical.
You know, John November, we don't think about the value of our really lush tree canopy in this area unless we see it suddenly going away. It's something that's just part of the landscape that people kind of take for granted, particularly in older Jacksonville neighborhoods, which have gorgeous old growth trees. But it really is part of the fabric of this community. And it seems to me over the years doing this program, this is an issue that really many local residents hold pretty dear. This is important to a lot of folks.
I think across the bipartisan spectrum, everyone intrinsically knows the value of trees. And today, our trees are under threat. And we have the opportunity to speak up, contact our legislators, go to Defend Florida Trees on Facebook and Instagram and jacksdigstrees.org online. Get involved and contact the people who are making decisions in Tallahassee that could affect every individual municipality in Atlantic Beach, Jacksonville. We have legislation going forward opposing these bills, but we need individuals in our community to step up to the plate, join us in this mission, and make sure that these devastating bills do not pass.
And it's 549-2937 if you have a question about Defend Florida Trees. Now, Anna Dooley, let me ask you, these bills have been introduced by a Democrat and a Republican. Representative Katie Edwards of Plantation, Florida, a Democrat. Senator Greg Stube of Sarasota, a Republican. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes.
Stube. They both say that under these new measures, local governments would no longer be allowed to prohibit landowners from trimming or removing trees on their own property. Local municipalities also could no longer require landowners to plant new trees or pay fees for removing them. So their argument seems to be the castle doctrine, that on your own property, you know, you can do what you want with your trees. What about that argument?
Well, one thing you need to realize is the reference to private property means it's owned by someone other than a government entity. So that could pertain to commercial development as well. And, you know, commercial development is really what decimates a lot of our urban forestry. Now, I heard a speaker from the U.S. Forest Service, and I think this is something we really need to think about, particularly here in Jacksonville. And her comment was that vibrant cities can cultivate thriving urban forests that boost public health, safety, sustainability, and economic growth. And I know Jacksonville wants to be a vibrant city. And, you know, we've got a lot of things going for us. And this is critical that if people are allowed, developers, whatever, to go in and cut trees, cut forests down, and not have any responsibility to replant or to mitigate for services, the city would be at a real loss for how to pay for tree maintenance in our city.
John November, your argument is that this would take away local control. What then is the motivation for these legislatures to introduce this legislation? Are they getting pressure from, say, development interests in the state? What's the backstory?
You know, it's really, it's like most things like this is a personal story. Senator Stubbe was trying to put a new garage and wanted to knock down some trees and couldn't believe that his local commission, all five Republican, when he went to them and said, you know, why am I having to pay mitigation for knocking these trees down? They said, because these are well-established laws. We care about our canopy. So instead of dealing with it on a local level and using local laws that have been established through grassroots efforts and the efforts of local communities like his own in Sarasota, he decided to go to Tallahassee and try to get state legislation passed that it's a square and a circle box a lot of times. It doesn't fit local communities with unique characteristics. And by pushing through legislation that will not create any true regulations for anywhere across the state, it could lead to a situation where clear cutting could occur and other activities that could really devastate our old growth forest long term.
You see this as a slippery slope to more clear cutting, is that right?
Yeah, I think right away.
And they would disagree with that, but that's what you think.
I think if this legislation passed, that clear cutting would happen immediately throughout the state, and then we would see the devastating effects as a community, and hopefully our local elected officials would then close that window, but it may be too late for some of our most cherished trees.
Now, as I said, Councilman John Cressenbeny has filed a resolution opposing this that he plans to send to Tallahassee. The co-sponsors are Anna Broche, Matt Schellenberg, Jim Love, Tommy Hazzuri. So certainly you have some bipartisan support with our local elected officials. Anna Dooley of Greenscape, your group is having a news conference about this in just under an hour, I believe. What's going to be happening?
Yes, yes. We'll be at Nathan Crestel Park, which is located off of San Jose Boulevard, close to the Epping Forest area. And we'll have several state and local dignitaries, as well as we hope a lot of concerned citizens to be there. It's as I said, just so important. This is a group, I will say, the Defend Florida Trees is an offshoot of Jack's Digs Trees, which is a consortium, if you will, of Greenscape and Scenic Jacksonville, and, of course, the Public Trust, and several other groups such as the Sierra Club. We came together to work diligently on Duval County, but moreover, we will be garnering other cities and municipalities to join us. And so that's why the name is Defend Florida Trees. It's not just Jacksonville Trees.
Jay tweets the show, "We must always remember the environment gets temporary wins and permanent losses. It takes centuries to get the kind of tree canopy Jacksonville has." And so we'll follow this story. Thank you both so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
John November of Defend Florida Trees and Anna Dooley, Executive Director of Greenscape of Jacksonville, with us. Later on, Cole Pepper on the Jaguars playoff hopes. Did you catch last night's game? My goodness. Crazy. But up next, how young performers are making the arts come alive thanks to PNC Arts Alive. We'll tell you about that right after this.
People in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
On Fresh Air, you can hear interviews that make you see the world in a new way.
Every drink of water you take, every pot of coffee you make is dinosaur pee because it's all been through the kidneys of a Tyrannosaurus rex or an Apatosaurus many, many times because all the water we have is all the water we have ever had.
You just never know what you'll learn next on Fresh Air. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
There's always something new happening in your community and your world. Whether it's Morning Edition tackling topical concerns in a smart, thoughtful way, or First Coast Connect introducing you to local artists and innovators, you can always count on WJCT to share a world of exploration with you. Make a year-end donation to ensure the programs you cherish and rely on continue to thrive throughout the year to come. Give online now at WJCT.org.
Welcome back. Well, this weekend, it will be a chance for local kids to share their talents on stage in front of their peers. This Saturday night marks the second annual Truth and Proof Youth Open Mic Night, and it's made free to the whole community thanks to PNC Arts Alive and their grant program across the country for the visual and performing arts. Catherine McAvoy runs the Performers Academy in Jacksonville, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And it's so good to see you. You know, you've done such a wonderful job with the Performers Academy. It's over on Beach Boulevard, and it's a place for young people to take classes and perform and develop their passion for the arts, which is so exciting.
Yes, and we really work on providing it for people who otherwise might not be exposed to the performing arts or not get a chance. So that's really the mission of the Performers Academy.
That's right. And there are, because arts programs in schools just aren't what they used to be. So kids, particularly in poor neighborhoods, can come to the Performers Academy and really, you know, explore their artistic side, whether it's dance, singing, acting. They get to do it all.
That's right. That's right. And the Youth Open Mic Night, which is this Saturday, is a once-a-month opportunity for kids to come for free and share their talents with their peers. Well, it's a really cool program that we've been doing now. This is the one-year anniversary, and we are able to do it because of PNC to offer it for free, that people can come in, kids can come in and sing, dance, act, do whatever they'd like, and share it with their peers. And we also have a guest artist every month. And it's just a really cool event.
It is cool. And PNC Arts Alive debuted their grant program back in 2009. They have awarded more than $13 million in grants in many states, including Florida, to cultural organizations like the Performers Academy, which is so cool. And I know that they've awarded quite a few grants right here in Jacksonville. So it's an open mic night. So anything goes?
Anything goes. We keep it PG. It's family friendly. So it's anything, almost anything goes. But it's, it's not just about spoken word or singing. So we've got people coming in this month. Our guest is a West African dance and drumming group, which is really, really cool. So they'll be doing dancing, and you'll see the dancers and the drummers. And it's the name of the group is the Nan Kama Pan, at West African Dance and Drum Ensemble. And so they'll share their talent. What we really try to do is give people who maybe they're not able to be at the level of Douglas Anderson. They didn't get into Douglas Anderson. They don't have an arts program in their school, and they get to come and try it in front of a group. Or they're at Douglas Anderson, or even some of the kids at FSCJ come in and they're trying to better themselves, and they don't have a area where they can go perform in front of their peers. You know, it's hard to get on stage. So this is an opportunity for whatever your passion is, whatever your performing arts is, come share it with your peers.
Sure. Now, you launched the Performers Academy after a very successful career in business. And this is your way of really giving back to this community, I think, in such a beautiful way. And I've loved watching the Performers Academy grow over the years.
Thank you. Yeah, it's changed. I started it as a facility that everyone could come to. Anybody could come and take their kids to sing, dance, and act in one under one roof. Since then, I was exposed to the underprivileged kids that weren't able to necessarily get these lessons, and didn't even know that you could do it. And so I have partnered with groups like FSS,
Family Support Services,
with the foster kids, and mm-hmm. some of the other groups that have programs for underprivileged kids or kids that are otherwise not served. And we do a lot of the free education and free performances. So that's really become our mission, which is great. It's arts for all, which is so important in the city.
When you go in, it's almost like, it reminds me of the movie Fame.
Yeah.
From the 80s.
The walls painted and stuff. Yeah, we do great camps there.
There's all this stuff going, you know, you walk down the hall and each room is like a different, you see dancers, you see singers, you see people composing music, you name it.
Yeah, and rapping, we do a lot with the electronic music or with
hip-hop,
with learning, the kids learn how to create beats or how to make music on the computer, which is really cool. And the teenage boys especially love that. And that's a great deterrent. If we can, that's what the whole Saturday night, the youth open night, mic night is about. If we can keep them busy and keep the kids together and do something that they become passionate about, then we can get them engaged. We can get them through high school. We can get them to have a career and be a great part of society. So it really makes an impact on the city.
Yeah, I mean, there's science and data to show that exposing children to the music and arts helps them improve their grades,
yep.
Including in math and science.
Yes.
It helps them professionally once they are out of school. There are lifelong dividends.
There are. And with it getting, like you said, cut from our school programs, a lot of the kids aren't even exposed to it. And, you know, people have got a bad taste in their mouth about rap or hip-hop, but rap is just, it's just rhyming. It's rhyming and poetry. Mm-hmm. And it's a great way to get kids exposed to English and to learn how to have a better control of the language, command of the language. It's really connects with the kids, and yet if we can do that, we can keep them involved and get them passionate and get them through school. And that's what we're trying to do with the arts.
That's what it's all about. So Saturday night is the night. How can people be part of this?
Yeah, just show up. It's free. I mean, why not, right? And mm-hmm. then bring your family, bring your kids. Doors open at 6:30. Show starts at 7:00. And people come and they sign up to perform. If they want to get on the list, they can just sign in. And then every performer gets a swag bag, so they get free gifts. If they don't want to perform, they don't have to. They can just watch instead. Then we'll have the guest artist there. And if we're not careful, she'll get you up and have you learn a couple of dance moves. But again, it's all whatever you want to do. You participate as much or as little as you like. The main thing is support the arts and support the kids.
Come on out Saturday, 7 p.m. to the Performers Academy for the Truth and Proof Youth Open Mic Night. It's free. They're on Beach Boulevard. Catherine, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
In a moment, the Jaguars' playoff hopes after beating Seattle. That's next.
The politics of evangelical Christians are front and center, whether it's the conduct of Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, America's official stance on Jerusalem, or the tax bill in Congress. Should Christianity shape policy, and how do evangelicals feel about their influence today? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, Godless, the new Netflix Western series, inspired by classic Westerns, but with some unconventional storylines. It's mostly set in a town run by women because the men died in a mining disaster. Jeff Daniels stars as a one-armed villain. We'll talk with Scott Frank, who wrote and directed all 7 episodes. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
The quiet small town of Palatka was once a popular tourist destination serving as a transportation hub for railroads and steamboat traffic on the St. Johns River. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit historic Palatka. We'll discuss the autobiography of Seminole War veteran F.C.M. Bogus and talk about the Miami Herald women's pages. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman telling me what to do.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the Jaguars make a statement in that big win over the Seahawks last night.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper says it shouldn't have been that close, but still, they'll take the win. And how about that end of the game fracas? I love that word, fracas. Good morning, Cole.
Good morning. Yeah, it was something. I think for a lot of folks, it was the first time in a long time, for some people, maybe the first time ever, depending on their age, that they had been in an environment like that in a Jaguars game at home. I have to think back to the last time there was a game that had that feel to it. You maybe go back to a Thursday night game against the Titans that didn't have as much on the line, maybe back in 2010, something like that. But this certainly did have a lot on the line, not only for the standings, but also sort of for putting a stamp of respect on the Jaguars around the National Football League. And I will say that Blake Bortles outplayed Russell Wilson, something that we probably would not have gotten a lot of takers on if you would have offered it up as a bet before the game. Wilson came in as an MVP candidate. He still is an MVP candidate, but he was intercepted 3 times by the Jaguars, did throw 3 touchdown passes as well. But Bortles was very good, and his play and the play of the defense in the first half in particular and the running game all came together as the Jaguars were able to come away with a 30-24 victory. Now, you mentioned the end of the game. Fracas, fracas, rhubarb, whatever. It was
melee. No fisticuffs. That's another word.
Well,
there was
a punch thrown in.
There was
appears.
A punt, one yeah. punch, yeah.
And so here's what happened. The Jaguars are in what's called the victory formation. That's when you see everybody tight to the line. The quarterback's just going to take the snap and kneel down and kill the clock off. And as they did this, there was a Seattle player, 2 Seattle players, Michael Bennett and Sheldon Richardson, who dove at the legs of Jaguars offensive linemen. That's a big no-no. That's outside of the unwritten
sure.
rules of football. The Jaguars took exception. Leonard Fournette took exception. And when Leonard takes exception, you notice it. things spilled over. And when one of the players, Quentin Jefferson, was ejected, he was walking back to the tunnel. Jaguars fans threw some cups or something
yeah,
at him.
Yeah.
And then he decided to retaliate by starting to go up into the stands. Now, I'll say this. It's dirty pool to dive at the legs of offensive linemen during a kneel down. Bad form. It's bad form to be throwing stuff at a player. Listen, shout whatever you want. As soon as fans start throwing things at players on the field, that's over the line. And then it's really over the line for a player to go to try to get up into the stands.
With the fans, yeah.
I mean, you got to be smarter than that. Jefferson said he wouldn't be disrespected. Well, you know, that is basically shorthand for he wanted to take his anger out on somebody, and he figured that flabby schmo in the crowd was easier to handle than the Jaguars offensive line.
But they come off like sore losers now, the Seahawks.
Terribly. And, yeah. And as Blake Bortles put it after the game, they are not used to getting whipped for 60 minutes, and that's what the Jaguars did. Remember, Michael Bennett, by the way, was a guy this past offseason who said, you know, the games in the NFL are close games, unless you're playing the Jaguars and you win by 50. Well, it didn't happen that way, Michael. You got ejected, and you got beat. And so here are the Jaguars now at 9-4, third best record in the AFC.
How about that?
With the Titans' loss, the Jaguars are now a game up in the AFC South with 3 to go. If the Jaguars beat Houston at home Sunday, they'll be in the playoffs. First winning season in 10 years has been clinched, and it was the first sellout since week one of last year. Great atmosphere. There were some delays for fans getting in and for cars getting out afterwards that I think the infrastructure has been gotten maybe comfortable with a certain number, but the great crowd last night for the Jaguars. And I think it meant something additional to the fan base. You know, for the last 10 years, basically, the Jaguars have been the butt of jokes in the National Football League.
Sure.
And this really highlighted and underscored the fact that this is a different team. It's a different situation. The Jaguars will not be bullied. The Jaguars are now the bully.
They're for real.
They are absolutely for real. I think they're going to win the division. I think they're going to have a home playoff game for the first time in a decade. And I don't think there's anybody in the AFC who wants to play the Jaguars right now. The fact that Blake Bortles is playing well enough and the way that that defense is playing, and remember, they played their second straight game without Telvin Smith, one of their defensive captains, and they still won. So things looking good as far as that's concerned.
Excellent. More football news. The Heisman Trophy going to Baker Mayfield over the weekend.
Yeah, and it's notable because the Oklahoma quarterback was a former walk-on. He walked on at Texas Tech, then got hurt, walked on at Oklahoma. It's the first time since scholarships had been awarded for athletics that a walk-on has won the Heisman Trophy. He's a bit controversial. He's very opinionated. And there are some who think that he may be a guy the Jaguars would look at in the draft this year. A little undersized, too. So interesting to see what's all going to play out as far as that's concerned. But the sixth Oklahoma Sooner to win the Heisman Trophy.
Nice. And last but not least, FSU undefeated. Let's talk for a minute about college basketball.
Yeah, it's been a crazy season in college basketball already. Three teams who started the season as Final Four contenders have lost back-to-back games already. Arizona, Florida, and Kansas have all done that. Florida State undefeated. This could be the year that a team like Florida State can find its way into the upper echelon and really contend. They've got a lot of talent there. I think this is going to be a very intriguing season in college hoops.
Always good to see you. Lots to talk about this week. Thanks, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right, that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Our producer is Kevin Murchard. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. 1A's up next with a look at what Roy Moore reveals about the religious right. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll see you tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.